And I've simply entitled this Loving While Defending. And I think probably most people are thinking we ought to love the person that we are defending the truth claims to, but that's really not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about loving God while defending. And for those who have been in apologetics for any length of time, one of the things that gives me some stress is the attitude with which apologists often engage in their craft. I watch them if they're debating in a university campus, and there often seems to be really kind of a lack should I even say godliness, about the way they go about the task. And those of you who are familiar, and I'm sure many of you are, with the writing of C.S. Lewis, but in his book, The Great Divorce, there's a great discourse that's going on between the spirit and the ghost. And at one point, Lewis has the spirit speak. There have been men before now who got so interested in proving the existence of God that they came to care nothing for God himself. And I would just say it is a very clear and present danger to all of us. And I think it's not just true of apologists. I've also seen it very evident in pastors. So it's not restricted to, but we're speaking to apologists here. And so what I'm going to look at are some of the things that I think we need to give attention to that will help us to maintain our right focus when we are defending the truth claims of Christ. That is not my first task. My first commitment is to love God. And to love God in the way I carry on with the task of defending his name. And I begin by thinking about wisdom and its importance, that is the wisdom from above. And in the wisdom is necessary for, I think, loving God well as serving men well. Proverbs 9:10 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight." The James 3 text, which is in the context where James is speaking, he's talking about teaching. When he says, "But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere." And he's speaking to those who are teaching. Remember, he starts off the chapter by saying that, in a sense, I'm paraphrasing now, that, you want to be a teacher? Wonderful. But just know this, that there's a greater judgment that goes to the teacher. Why? Well, because we are presenting ourselves as truth tellers. And if we're not clear, either in how we say it or what we are saying, then we are failing our Lord. And this idea of wisdom that we have from, we need the wisdom in our teaching, and the wisdom from above, he says, it's peaceable, it's gentle, it's open to reason. So as we think about defending the truth claims of Christ, there is this sense that we need to be gentle. I've known some who have not been so gentle. I was debating an atheist on a university campus, and afterwards a young man came up to me and he said, "Why didn't you knock him out? You had him on the ropes." Now he might have been totally wrong about that. And I said, I hope I wasn't too flippant about it, but I said, I don't think Jesus would do that. We don't trample on people because godly wisdom and the godly individual must be gentle, and then this idea of being open to reason. That is, to be willing to reason with those who may disagree with me, but to reason in a way that is indicative of the reality of Christ in us, the hope of glory, full of mercy as we teach, as we defend the truth claims of Christ. A sense of mercy, I think, and as we've already established, I am old, so I have many years to look back on, and I think of all the times that I didn't have mercy. Sometimes because I thought, I can take this person down in an argument. Well, it's not too difficult these days to take people down because they often don't have much of an argument. And that's no problem. You can do that, but I don't think that's what those of us who are committed to the truth claims of Christ, we're committed to them because of the truth of God. And good fruit, impartial and sincere. That is, even insincere in our arguments, that we treat information properly. I have noticed that Christians often will pick and choose what statistics they want to use in their argument. Well, that's all well and good, unless you're in front of 5,000 people and somebody knows other statistics, and there you go. Embarrassment. Colossians tells us to walk in wisdom to whom? Outsiders. Who are they? They are the people to whom we are speaking, making the best use of the time. It's a very interesting concept that we have here, making best use of our time. What do I spend my time doing? Because I've done a number of debates, I don't want to craft this talk around doing formal debates. It just is applicable to anything. Whether you're talking to your neighbor across the fence, or you're talking to an academic, let your speech always be seasoned with salt so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. And this is why I have been somewhat resistant to all the methodological apologetic books. Everybody's different. I don't know that I've ever really used exactly the same thing to every individual. I was talking with a lady on a plane, and we were sitting side by side because that was assigned seats. I didn't just scope her out and want to sit beside her. And she said to me, oh, she had a book of Ayn Rand. And I said, oh, I see you're reading Ayn Rand. Atlas shrugged. And she says to me, yes, have you ever read anything by this author? Oh, yes, I said, I've read something. She said, what? I said, I read her Objectivist Epistemology. Oh, and the lady, she looks at me, and she says, what do you do for a living? Well, I understood where that question came from. And I'm not ashamed that I teach philosophy and that I'm a Christian and I teach philosophy in a seminary. But you know, when you tell somebody that, you're afraid they're going to push the call button and ask the flight attendant, could I please change my seat? Because who wants to be caught on a flight of 8 or 9 hours with a kook sitting beside me? But she says, oh, I'm so glad you're sitting beside me, because I've got so many questions. It was at that moment that I pushed the call button. But you know, we were having this discussion, and she was a fourth or fifth generation Mormon who'd left Mormon and she had become, she was in the New Age movement. And as we try to talk about things, of course, talking with such people with that ideology is more like trying to make jello stick to the wall than anything else, because they're slippery, they're all over the place. And no way could I really get to, as I say, get to her. And I'm just sitting there thinking and praying, Lord, what do I say now? And I turned to her because she had been saying, you know the route. Oh, I just think you shouldn't bother another person about your beliefs, about what's right and what's wrong. You ought to just leave everybody alone and let them live with their own right and wrongness. Now, I said, what am I going to do? She's already told me she doesn't want to listen to me. So I said, I don't know why I said this, but I'm pointing out that I've never said this before. After this time, I asked her, did she have any grandchildren? Now, I will tell you, that's risky these days. If anybody's got a cell phone, you are now going to have to watch, I don't know how many hours of the most brilliant children in the universe, okay, with all the glowing comments that come with each picture. And you can't, you know, you want to keep up appearances. So I said, well, this is marvelous. I said, how is it going? She said, it's not going very well. I said, that's interesting. Why? Well, she said, my daughter does not know how to raise her children properly. I said, She said, so I go over two or three times a week, and I'm trying to train my grandchildren about right and wrong. Yeah, you get the point, right? And I said to this lady, I said, you know, you've got me somewhat confused. I said, simply a few minutes ago, you were saying we shouldn't be doing this sort of thing. You shouldn't be going over to your grandchildren and telling them that you know what's right for them. And there was a long pause. And then she said this, of which I've never forgotten. She said, I can't have it both ways, can I? I can't have it both ways. So I had touched her in an area, not logic, but an area of her affections. What was more important to her of those two items? Was it more important to stay with her so-called ideology, or was it more important to her that her grandchildren would be raised properly? And I remember leaving as we're walking down the jet bridge, and I guess that's what we call it, and she said, how long are you going to be in Amsterdam? I would like to have you come home and talk with my husband. Well, unfortunately, I had to get off. I had another flight to take. But this idea of knowing how to answer each person, have no preconceived notions of what you're going to see or what you're going to hear. Oh, this person comes from this place, so I bet they're that. Now, when I lectured, and still do, but back in the early 90s, when I lectured in many universities in Eastern Europe, I could pretty much know that the people who would be hearing me were probably either unbelievers or actually atheists. So I didn't have to go into conversation with them. But when I'm meeting people along the way, I don't know what they're, and I don't know what works with them. I don't know what will be something that I say that just catches it. So I've never asked a person with whom I was speaking, when I didn't know what else to say, do you have any grandchildren? No, of course not. It was at one time, and it, as I would say, it worked. But I didn't know it would when I asked it. And I think this is where we begin to depend on the Spirit of God to give leadership in what we are doing. That's why I say I think there's a danger of methodological dependence. I'm not saying there's no value in it. I'm only saying don't get tied too tightly to it. Be able to engage in conversation because you love God, you love humanity. I learned that from someone else by the name of Francis Schaeffer. Human wisdom is no match for the complexities of this life. Life is very complex. It doesn't usually retreat in a particular argument. Sometimes it does. And complex life require thinking things through and not having simple answers. Again, Schaefer would always say that we give honest answers to honest questions. Read humanity from our theology and not from our culture. I don't like people, if they find out that I'm a Christian, assume that I must believe this or that. Oh, so you're a Baptist. I guess you must be a teetotaler. Well, I am, but it's not because I'm a Baptist. Or, you're a Baptist. I bet you don't go to dances. No, I don't go to dances. But it's not because I'm a Baptist. It's because I'm too old. If you ever see me play tennis, you would realize why I would not go to dances. So I think we read humanity from our theology. As Christians, we should best know humanity. And I think, I don't want to overemphasize Francis Schaefer, but you'll know he had an impact on my life. He might not want to recognize that if he was standing here today, but his deep love for humanity. And we love humanity, not because of what it does, but because of who it is. And it's God's image. And so my loving God is so important when I'm dealing with people, because that's how I help to, that's how I am helped in loving God. Wisdom to resist reaching the world on the world's terms. There's a great temptation to that. It just is. The world tells us that this is really successful. I can grow your group from 20 to 500 in 3 weeks. And we think, I bet we could use those same kind of techniques over here. And then how do you know, was it your technique or the Spirit of God working on the hearts of men and women? So I say, we need to resist that. I'm not saying there's nothing in the world that we can't use. Please understand me. But I see, because I think there's an overuse here, I probably am making an overstatement. But you will know that old men tend to do that. Talk about what the world is not talking about. We always talk about the elephant in the room, or at least talk of it differently. I've been in conversation and over some certain issues in our country, and it's on what is called systemic racism or institutional racism. And I had written something and somebody else put it up publicly, and that was fine with me. I told them they could. But then this great debate came up, and some other Christians got involved and retweeted. Well, then, of course, the secular press picked it up and said to the man who retweeted it, do you believe what Dr. Little said? Because I had said systemic racism is a myth. And it was just a little statement I made in there, right? So this person who's now on the carpet before a particular liberal newspaper, he emails me and he says, well, I'm really in an agreement with you. And I said, okay, so what are you going to say? He said, well, I say, no, I don't agree with Dr. Little on this matter of systemic racism being a myth. Because he said, it's true. And I said, so what do you mean by that? Oh, he says, I mean that all people are born sinners. I thought to myself, that's dishonest. That is not how our culture is using the term systemic racism. So we need to really be, if we're going to talk about these things, we need to talk about them in Christian categories, not in the world's categories. The idea of equality and equity, these two things that are, now we no longer talk about equality, we talk about equity. And so I hear Christians say, oh, but it means the same thing. Oh, I see. I wonder why they don't use equality anymore, and they're using equity. They're not the same thing. So as Christians, we present ourselves in a way trying to kind of, you know, nestle up to the world, and we want to sound relevant, and we want to sound we really know. But by doing this, what we're really showing is we don't know. The importance of reinforcing right sentiments in the Christian, and that is the sentiments that focus on our relationship with God. That's first and foremost. I'm not called first and foremost to be a pastor or an apologist. I'm called to love God. I'm called to witness to Him, but I witness of Him because, first of all, I love Him. Now, it is possible to witness verbally about God without loving Him. And some people are confused, I think, and they think because they do this that that is loving God. And I would suggest that's a confusion of effect, cause and effect. The primary concern of Jesus with Peter is, do you love me? Ask it three times. If we're going to work for God, we must know what it is to love God. And that's not something, you know, you define it and all the rest of it, and might be more difficult, of course. But I think we know what, in general terms, it means to love God. So I say that doing is not necessarily loving. Obedience over sacrifice. You remember that's what is told in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 22. I'm doing something, so I must love God. I know a lot of people who are doing things that don't know much about the love of God. But it's not that they're not doing good things, it's that they're confused that doing good things is the same as loving God. The sentiments are like beliefs. They need to be closely audited, as they are easily disordered in our world that is so disordered. What do I do in order to keep my sentiments? When I mean sentiments, I mean the things that I think are most important. That's what we mean by a sentiment. And because they are most important, those are the things that I love, all right? It's so easy, particularly in ministry of some kind, any kind, it's so easy for our sentiments to get disordered. As if we were to read the whole section of Lewis in the divorce, Great Divorce, he will say that when people, you know, they're so involved in God, they stop loving God, he will say, and eventually all they're concerned about is their own personality and their own prominence within. Is that a temptation to any of us? I'm talking to you, not me. It's never been a temptation to me. Right. I'm reading the Chronicles. No, I'm reading The Lord of the Rings right now with my granddaughter, who is 24. I've been speaking to my granddaughter by phone ever since she was 4 years old, and I've done it on a weekly basis whenever I'm in the country. And she says, Babu, that's what she calls me. She thought I was a baboon, but when she was real young, she couldn't get out baboon, so Babu was a good alternative. And so we've been talking, if anything you know, about the last one, that hideous strength, and how Mark so desperately wants to be on the inside. You tell me that we haven't struggled with the same thing. Wanting to be on the inside, want to be admired, respected, so to speak. So I say we need to do things that keep our sentiments. And I would say, if you look at Pilgrim's Progress by Bunyan, he has a line in there about keeping wake, and that Christians in fellowship is a great way. I've really murdered it, but it's a general thought that Christians in fellowship keep us awake. And I'm saying, only try to be in fellowship, try to be in community, even if it's only one other person who is willing to help us keep our sentiments ordered properly. The pressure of disorder. Sentiments or affections reflect the things we love and what we think is important. Nothing moves us away from our first love quicker than success. And I think we have many examples, unfortunately, of that. Right now, there's a great hullabaloo. I haven't read it all because I'm here and within the Southern Baptist Convention in the States. It is so disheartening. So disheartening. And it involves people that I know. I mean, we're not the only ones who've gone through that, right? But what happens? Some pastor goes in, and he has a small group of people, and God blesses, and all of a sudden he's now got 2,000 people, and everybody wants to have him the speaker in their church to tell how they do it. Gosh, do we understand how easy it is for us to be moved away from our first love simply by our success? We start loving the telling rather than the one of whom we are telling. I kind of adapted that from Augustine. Augustine says, you remember when he's talking about music, he said, when I sing and find that I am enjoying the singing more than the one I'm singing about, Augustine said, I have sinned. That's pretty strong words. That's Augustine's word, okay? That's it. But isn't that a danger? I love to hear my own voice. Well, I'm not speaking necessarily. I'm just speaking in general. I don't have that great a voice, but it is true, isn't it? And so nothing moves us away. And so this upsets, this disorders our sentiments, our affections. And the center has to be God. The attraction of the world is more powerful than most of us realize. You think you can walk through it unscathed. Oh, no. If we think that, we really don't understand the true nature of our world. In a sense, we are at war. I mean that carefully, but the world is not looking to cheer us along on the Christian way. They, in fact, would do what they possibly can. Controversy can corrupt proper sentiments. Schaeffer says that beware of habits learned in controversy. And that is so true. He had learned it the hard way, and that's what led him to make a major decision in 1955. These are all things that can disorder us. And I'm saying, loving God while we are defending. And if we're really successful in defending, what is always before us is the challenge or the danger is that all of a sudden we become more ordered, as it were, by our own personalities, our own success. The importance of understanding the nature of the battle. I know that this may sound somewhat overly spiritual, but I think we've lost the sense of the nature of the battle. When you and I are defending the truth claims of Christ, the battle is real. There's a cosmic battle going on. And it is over the issue of truth. So Ephesians, right, chapter 6 tells us about this battle. Jesus engaged in the battle, not that we're Jesus. So we just need to be aware of the spiritual world. Ephesians chapter 6, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. Do we really believe that? Do we really believe that we are in our own strength, in our education, I have two PhDs, I can do it. I'd rather do it myself. There used to be an advertisement that advertised something like that. And sometimes we just think, I can rest on that. God help us that we do not seek the face of God to look at whatever I do as a way of loving my God and trusting what he has provided in his Spirit. Light and darkness are just simply hostile contraries. Human tools by themselves do not work well against the enemy. I'm not saying we can't use them. And who is it? Peter Berger, who said that he who dines with the devil of modernity must do so with a long-handled spoon. So we must realize that tools themselves do not work well, and you realize that often when you and I pick up a tool, we don't just get a tool. We get the entire toolbox. There's always philosophies that are woven into these tools, and we must be careful about using them because they don't work well. The importance of developing the mind. To know God's thoughts by shaping our mind. I've pondered on this idea of, well, I think I have it, Matthew chapter 22. And this is just the one place. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. That's a pretty tall order. And it's pretty encompassing, is it not? Just to love my God. Will it cost me at points? Yes. Those of you who are familiar with the Solzhenitsyn's little essay he wrote just before he was expelled from Moscow, deported to Germany and then to the United States, he wrote this little essay to the intellectuals of Moscow. It was titled, Live Not by Lies. And we can't love God with a mind that's not been transformed by the Word of God and by the Spirit of God. We're just no battle for the lies of the enemy. This is the great. So I've already spoken about, part of this involves, I think, knowing the true nature of the world. I think critical thinking is essential to understanding the world. You know, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present yourselves a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be ye transformed, and be not conformed to this world, be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. That's just a process that keeps going on. And sometimes we lose ground on it. That's all there is. If the mind isn't being always challenged and we're not thinking about these things, it slips. We lose ground in how we think, because the thinking of the world is often so attractive. Critical thinking, critical thinking, I believe, is a lost art in Christianity. I was in a still very communistic country, and I was asked to teach a group of Christians. And what did they want me to teach on? Critical thinking. And as I was teaching this, they kept saying, we have never heard anything like this. Now, they weren't saying I was so eloquent. They're just simply saying they had not heard about critical thinking. How do you challenge ideas, assumptions, etc.? Well, that's part, I think, of loving God. We are not to love the world, nor the things of the world, or the thinking of the world. Is John right on that? John, 1 John 2:15. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. Is John right about that, or is he not? Keep the mind properly ordered, knowing how to distinguish between trivial and the essential. Philippians chapter 1, verse 10, Paul talks about that you might discern the things that are excellent. But if you look at the word, it's the things that are essential. We only have so much time, right? We only have so much money. Well, some of you. Do we know how to look at life today and be able to distinguish between what is essential that must be said, what is essential that must be done, and over here, what's this non-essential? Doesn't mean we can't do it, but we never want to swap out the essential for the non-essential. What does Lewis say? Lewis says something about putting second-place things in first place. So you see, great men before me have been saying these things. But I'm saying it's a constant battle. It's just a constant battle for us. And I think because we are apologists and we have a love for the Word of God and for the truth of God, it is still that it's easy to these things to walk away from us. Loving God is first order, which means loving his thoughts as revealed in his word, so I can think as God. What did he say? But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord is holy, always being prepared to make a defense. This is the text we all use in apologetics. And yet we just pick out this one little piece to make a defense. And I'm not saying that's not true, but we skip what's going on in before and after. In your hearts, honor Christ. First order thing is loving God. Always prepared, yes, yet do it in gentleness and with respect. Another thing, see, if we don't do the first, the second will not follow. Well, here we go again. Lewis, yet being dead, speaketh. And this is his, how many are familiar with this prayer of Lewis? Lewis tells us that this from this poem that he wrote, he realized that as a spokesperson and a defender, he said, of the Christian faith, that how easy it was for us to be absorbed, become self-absorbed. So he says, for all my lame defeats, and oh, much more, from all the victories that I seem to score, from cleverness shot forth from thy behalf, at which while angels weep, the audience laughs. From all my proofs of thy Trinity, thou who wouldst give no sign, deliver me. Now he's not saying these things are not important, please understand. He doesn't want what I'm doing to find its first place. Then he says, thoughts are but coins. Let me not trust instead of thee their thin, worn image of thy head. From all my thoughts, even from my thoughts of thee, O thou fair silence, fall and set me free. Lord of the narrow gate and the needle's eye, take from me all my trumpetry, lest I die. Lewis.